Of all the controversial allegations that have come out post 9/11 about what the intelligence community has been doing in secret, we have not seen any credible allegations of a return to the kind of abuse of the intelligence agencies for political means. Right. And that's what this seems to be. Right. So it really is a return to the pre-church type of thing. At least an allegation.
And that's kind of what I'm getting to, which is why, you know, again, for me, but maybe for the country as a whole, there's the reaction reflects the fact that we understand this was part of our history, but that we've moved beyond and we've taken incredible steps to prevent presidents from acting unilaterally to conduct surveillance on American citizens. And
especially for political ends, for self-serving political ends, which is what the charge was.
Right, for political reasons. Yeah. Which And so this is something we've, you know, as a country, has been very traumatic for us. And we've gotten through it. And here we are in 2017 to have that allegation.
I'm Quinta Jurassic, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, March 11th, 2017. This week on the podcast, Lawfare's Jack Goldsmith sat down to chat with former director of the National Counterterrorism Center, Matt Olson. Between the president's tweeted allegations of politically motivated wiretapping, the release of the revised executive order restricting entry into the United States from six majority Muslim countries, a recent surge of airstrikes in Yemen, and WikiLeaks' high-profile release of CIA hacking tools, the two had plenty to talk about. And that's aside from the broader question of Trump's relationship with the intelligence community and the effects of his persistent attacks on its integrity. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 212, Jack Goldsmith and Matt Olson on the current state of national security.
So Matt, the first thing I want to talk about is what you imagine it's like to be a member, say a senior member of the intelligence community under President Trump. I imagine, so what is the impact of his various attacks on the integrity of the intelligence community? What is the impact of his, what seems to be fishing around for intelligence to support certain policy determinations that have already been made, maybe in the immigration context? Just talk to us about how the intelligence community might react to that.
Yeah, I think it's actually hard to overstate the impact of the criticisms that have been leveled against the intelligence community on the morale of the rank-and-file intelligence officer. You know, you have people who, whether they've spent 1 year or 30 years in the intelligence community, who view their most important role as being objective and nonpartisan and building facts and providing those facts and analysis to policymakers. And when the criticism is that, you know, that they're biased or that they are politically driven, it just sort of cuts to the core of who they are and their identity as intelligence officers. And I think that definitely in the long term, but really I think right now, is having a significantly negative impact on them.
So I'm confident that it has a terrible morale impact. I've talked to friends in the intelligence community and they say that morale is as low as they recall it ever. Some of them have also said, though, that you know, they carry on. One of the kind of defining characteristics of the intelligence community is they don't get credit. They're always being criticized. So they're used to adversity. Is this something different? Is it different coming from the president?
No, I think it's totally different. I think it, you know, yes, there's no doubt that people who serve in these roles are, you know, they know that they're not going to get credit, and they're likely going to be criticized. And we've seen that, right, over the last 15 years.
Criticized when something goes wrong.
When something goes wrong.
And they don't get credit for the many things that they do right.
Right. And that sort of, it's that comes with the territory. I think it's different when, one, that it comes from the president and from the White House, but two, when it goes to not just that they made bad decisions or their judgment was flawed, but that their motives are impugned, and not just any motive, but the motive that I mentioned, that they are objective and nonpartisan, and when that's called into play or called into question, I think it goes more to the heart of why these folks are, you know, doing the jobs that they chose to do.
And do you think, I mean, how will it impact? There have been stories about people leaving NSA at higher rates than usual. Is the impact people don't work as hard? Is the impact people start guarding their advice? Is the impact What is the impact?
Yeah, I think it's hard to predict. I do think it's hard to keep in people, good people, and also to recruit. You know, if I were, when I was at NCTC, 1,200 people, I would go into these briefings every morning or in the afternoon to prepare me to go to the White House. And the table would be surrounded by just incredibly talented, largely younger folks who came out of incredibly great graduate programs or had terrific jobs before and could have done a lot of different things. They could have gone to work on Wall Street or in Silicon Valley, made a lot more money, and they had chosen to go after Al-Qaeda. That was what they wanted to do. So now you have a young person with those options, and they're now being told that, compared to Nazis, for example, what's the motivation for them at that point to go take on these, underpaying jobs where they sort of toil in anonymity? And so, yeah, we may not see that impact tomorrow or next week, but I think that there's a potential for a longer-term
corrosive train. Effect over time and the ability to retain and hire.
Yeah.
Not to mention the everyday morale problems.
But what I don't think that what we're seeing will cause anyone to, change their analysis.
Right.
I think the level of professionalism is such that they're going to be straight shooters regardless of what sort of arrows are being, slung at them.
The people I've talked to say basically that it's very discouraging, but that they're serving the executive branch and the goals of the executive branch generally and not just a particular president and the country. And
right.
I think that that's the way they view their job, regardless of who's the president, even though if the president is making it much harder for them.
Right.
Speaking of morale, there was a story today. We don't really fully know yet what the scope is, but about this leak from the CIA about some of their offensive cyber tools. And assuming that this is legit, I'm just wondering we're starting to see so much leaking out. We have been for a while, so much leaking out of the intelligence community. This, on top of stuff that might have leaked out from the NSA late last year, of some of their tools, on top of Snowden, on top of Manning leaks. And it just seems like, and that's just one slice of it, and then it just seems like there's just a lot of talking coming out of the intelligence community. Does that have a corrosive impact? Did people notice that? What impact does that have?
Obviously this just happened today.
Yeah.
We just saw the news today on this WikiLeaks dump. Yeah, I do think this has a corrosive effect. It's the kind of problem that I think we're going to continue to see because it's very hard for the government apparently to keep these things secret. So I do think that there's a morale problem there. But the first thing I thought of, because I also was in office at NCTC after Snowden, and one of the concerns I've had is, NCTC was sort of the organizational example of sharing of information and the need to share, the change after 9/11 toward a norm of making sure that a lot of people had access to the terrorism information that we were collecting. And that's a very important and helpful norm that was established after 9/11. So these leaks cut in the other direction, right? So, there's going to be an impulse to return perhaps to a time when you didn't share information that was really sensitive because you were afraid that it would leak out.
But isn't that an inevitable trade-off? I can't remember if it was Dulles or Helms who said that the possibility of a leak increases exponentially with the number of eyeballs on a piece of information.
Right.
And it seems to me that we had a problem before 9/11. There wasn't enough information sharing across the intelligence community. But one consequence of sharing, especially when things are in digital form, is it's just going to be very hard to keep secrets. So how do you, is it impossible to think about that balance in general terms? Do you have to just keep adjusting it? Or do you still think that despite the leaks that it's important to have wide sharing?
Yeah, I think on balance, at least in the counterterrorism context, the value of sharing outweighs the danger of leaks. We just haven't, and I guess the danger is that the pendulum, I just see the pendulum potentially swinging too far in the direction of not sharing information in a way that will be operationally optimal. The problem what we have, if again, assuming this information is genuine, is these are sort of quintessential sources and methods.
Yeah.
This is not...
It's not really about sharing. It sounds like CIA tools, the Snowden stuff was largely about NSA tools and liaison services tools. That wasn't really about sharing. That's really about the digitalization of secrets and the ability to download and circulate them in seconds in massive amounts. And the great difficulty that the entire intelligence community has had in locking down those secrets. It just seems to me that it really is more a point about digitalization and the size of the secrecy bureaucracy than it is about sharing.
Yeah, and I think that's right. And the ease with which it's possible now to disclose this information, apparently, in large amounts because of the digitalization. I also was at the Justice Department 10 years ago when we were looking at potential cases for prosecuting leakers, and it's just really hard to prosecute.
Hard to bring
leakers.
Those cases.
Those cases are really hard to bring. Yeah. Doesn't act as much of a deterrent as a consequence.
So I completely agree with you, but that's highly counterintuitive. The conventional wisdom is that the Obama administration had more leak prosecutions than in all of American history combined prior to that, which is true. But it's also true, I think the lesson is, half those cases fell apart at the end.
Right.
It's really, and the vast majority of leaks go uninvestigated, or if investigated, without prosecution, because, as you say, finding out who did it and finding out and being able to use these antiquated laws to bring the prosecution, I assume those are the main problems.
Yeah.
Identifying the person and using the Espionage Act. But what are the hurdles?
Well, it's number one, finding out who. Identifying the sort of circle of potential suspects, because as soon as you go beyond a certain number, you've pretty much made the case an impossible one.
What about the argument that digital footprints are everywhere now, and that it's easy, especially with metadata, that it's easy to figure out who's talking to whom? Do you think that's overblown?
I mean, that helps in the investigation, but I think it's overblown if the notion is that helps, in a dispositive way, crack the cases. But the other problem, beyond the ones that you mentioned, is the sort of gray mail problem.
Yeah,
so that
exactly.
To be able to bring these cases, you're often in a position of having to make some really difficult choices about what you can use as evidence and the potential then in using evidence to prosecute the case, you're going to disclose additional secrets.
Because the defendant is going to insist on more of that evidence, is going to try to insist on more classified information coming
out. It's even before the defendant uses it as a tactic. I mean, it's somewhat pejoratively referred to kind of as a defense tactic, but it's just a fact of the case for the prosecution that you're going to have to bring information into open court that may be really sensitive. But then, you, as you said, Jack, I mean, the defendants know there's good defense lawyers. There's a handful of really good defense lawyers who do these cases. They know how to really make it very difficult for the government.
And so I think it's a great point because, all of this, the claims that those few sort of stilted prosecutions, relatively few given the size of the number of leaks, stilted prosecutions had this devastating chilling effect on leaks, seems belied by the leaks that are just pouring out, classified leaks every day.
Yeah.
Let's move to, I just wonder if you have any thoughts about such a broad topic. President Trump's claim last week that President Obama ordered a wiretap on Trump Tower. There's been a lot of discussion about whether that was true. The Obama administration, Obama through a spokesman, denied it. DNI Clapper denied it. Do you have any general reactions to that? I mean, how should we react to what the president did? How should we think about it?
It is a big question, and I have to say, just at a very just visceral level, I was blown away. Like probably a lot of the listeners were.
Explain why. Yeah, I was too, but explain why.
The nature, an allegation. Like this, basically an allegation of criminal conduct coming by one president, our current president, against a former president, his immediate predecessor, on the scale of the accusation, which was illegal wiretapping, which really cuts to the core of our democracy, right? This is the reason,
especially in a political context.
In a political context against the campaign, it's an explosive allegation that. It seems to me the only reason it probably didn't get more of a reaction is that it comes from President Trump, who has a penchant for these kinds of accusations.
So people discount it?
They
discount
it.
Had a pretty big reaction.
But still, this seems to me to be the kind of, there's been some press that this may be different from his other, claims of like how many people were engaged in voter fraud and things that were provably false. This seems to me to potentially be more explosive.
Especially since it seems so, at least on the specific claim that he made, utterly groundless. The White House has not been able to come up with any basis for it other than some television news programs.
Right.
Well, but I agree with you. My intuition is exactly what you said, that it's terribly corrosive on the political process and on the democracy, and it's on our democracy, and it's another example of Trump kind of blowing through norms that have always governed presidential behavior that we never appreciated before. But why exactly? What is exactly the problem? Is it an attack on truth, and truth is the basis for government, and that it seems so inappropriate to go after the former president if there's not something backing this allegation up? I mean, I share your reaction to it. I thought when I saw the tweet, I thought, wow, that's a step beyond everything that's been shocking during the presidency. But it's not clear why is it different than saying judges are going to be responsible for terrorism and the judges are politically motivated, or comparing the intelligence community to Nazis. And it just seems like the latest irresponsible, right. corrosive jab right. by the president. Is there something yet worse about this? Is it because it's the former president?
Well, I think it's one, that it's the former president, and it's quite personal. But I have to say, I looked at it slightly through the lens of, you know, I'm here at Harvard teaching a class this semester, and I'm teaching.
So we're recording this from Harvard Law School, where Matt's teaching a seminar on national security law.
And we have just gotten through 4 weeks in this seminar of talking about FISA and foreign intelligence surveillance. And we started with sort of a historical look back at the Church Committee and the abuses of the 60s and 70s. And so, you know, first of all, the events over the weekend are a fantastic teaching opportunity for these students, right? It's unbelievable in some ways. But
so let's just play that out. It's unbelievable because of all the controversial allegations that have come out post 9/11 about what the intelligence community has been doing in secret, we have not seen any credible allegations of a return to the kind of abuse of the intelligence agencies for political means.
Right.
And that's what this seems to be.
Right.
So it really is a return to the pre-church.
Yeah.
Type of thing. At least an allegation.
And that's kind of what I'm getting to, which is why, you know, again, for me, but maybe for the country as a whole, there's the reaction reflects the fact that we understand this was part of our history, but that we've moved beyond, and we've taken incredible steps to prevent presidents from acting unilaterally to conduct surveillance on American citizens. And
especially for political ends, for self-serving political ends, which is what the charge was.
Right, for political reasons. Yeah. Which And so this is something as a country, has been very traumatic for us. And we've gotten through it. And here we are in 2017 to have an allegation that we are, you know, that the President of the United States is engaged in activity that, you know, is
Made by the current president.
Yeah, by the current president. So I don't know where this goes, but I do think that's what I just said also, I think, sort of reflects or was reflected in Ben Rhodes' tweet, which I thought really captured it quite well.
What did he say?
He said, he basically said that we have, the president can't order wiretaps. Those restrictions were put in place to protect American citizens from people like you.
Yeah.
A tweet directed right at President Trump. But it's kind of like it captured.
In other words, a person who would tweet groundlessly about that is the type of person that might well try to use the intelligence agencies for political ends if we didn't have all these
restrictions in place. Or, you know, who has otherwise shown a lack of regard for the constraints on the office, right, and the norms of democratic processes. So that's what, and I think that maybe gets to it too a bit, which is this reflects, a continuation of this idea that the president is not really bound by some of the norms that come to the office.
I mean, I feel very strongly I'm not worried about him violating the laws. It's the norms.
Right.
And it's norms of decency and decorum and politeness and civility that really sort of make our democracy possible. And he's continuously blowing through them. It's not clear what the impact is, but it doesn't seem good at all.
And you know, Jack, as well as anyone, given your scholarship, you know, there's a lot that the president can do that isn't just in the nature of is it legal or is it not legal. And to
Lawful, but awful.
Yeah. is that the academic term for it?
That's the phrase some people are using.
Right. So the going after the institutions and delegitimizing institutions, whether it's the press, the judiciary, the federal workforce, the intelligence community, those are, you know, this is, and now kind of the, you know, president, putting President Obama into that, you know, I think is, yeah, that's all very troubling.
And it's hugely troubling, and it's very hard to understand what the end is, what the goal is, other than just the destruction of the institutions, which is kind of a hard thing to fathom the President of the United States doing.
Right.
All right, let's try to move on to something slightly less depressing, although not that much less depressing. There was a new immigration executive order yesterday. It, as Ben wrote, it appeared to have tightened up a lot of the more objectionable provisions, and it now excludes from the temporary ban lots of people with permanent connections to the United States. It takes Iraq off the list of Iraqi citizens off the list. And it also gives discretion to Border Patrol to make exceptions in particular cases. So it looks to me, we don't have to get into the legal issues, the president has enormous delegated authority in this context, and it's also a context where he gets enormous deference from the courts. It seems to me this order might be approaching legality. It's certainly a lot closer to the line than the other one was. Setting legality aside, do you have a view about whether this furthers or doesn't further either the old EO or the new one as narrowed, furthers or doesn't? What's the impact on our counterterrorism goals? Because that's the purported point of this, right, is to further our counterterrorism strategy. So does it do that?
Right. I think it does not do that. I mean, to get right to the bottom line. At NCTC, we played a really important role in helping to vet people who are coming here, whether it's through visa programs where we would run names against the intelligence databases that included the watch lists that NCTC helped to maintain, as well as the refugee programs, and particularly with regard to Iraqi refugees. And we were part of the effort to really tighten up the vetting after 2012 of Iraqi refugees. So I take and accept and support the idea that we need to be really careful about who we let into this country.
Right.
And we need to, particularly those coming here who we may have information on, that they may be involved or connected to people who are, involved in terrorism. And the other point I think is to acknowledge is there are places that we have less information than other places, right?
So right.
Those are all, I think, worthy of acknowledging and trying to figure out, okay, how do we, given those facts, how do we
right.
design a system that's going to help us?
Right.
And so I come at it from that perspective, from a security perspective. The problem is with this executive order and the first executive order, and in some ways, they're very similar, despite the changes.
It's cleaned up. It's basically the same, but cleaned up.
Yeah, it's cleaned margins. Up, and it takes care of some of the more glaring sort of issues, including sort of the legal issues. I agree with you, legally, there's so much deference given to the president here. Remains to be seen, I guess, legally, because I'm
but
sure
certainly he's challenged. This is in better shape than the other
yeah,
ones.
Yeah, I think that's fair. But the problem is that it will still be viewed as an effort to prevent Muslims from coming into the country. And that's because, in part, it's focused on six countries that have really no or very little connection to the broader problem that we face in the United States of people carrying out terrorist attacks. I mean, there's been so much written in the last couple of weeks about the notion that, you know, the vast majority of the attacks in the United States, people arrested for terrorists or actual successful attacks or lethal attacks carried out by people who are American citizens or legal permanent residents. And that the biggest problem we have, first and foremost, and I truly believe this, is the radicalization of individuals who are in the country now.
So what is the impact of this order on that?
Yeah, so all this will do, and this is where the fundamental problem is, to the extent, and I understand why it is viewed this way, and to the extent that it's viewed as an anti-Muslim or a Muslim ban, it will only further work to further marginalize people in this country. It will add to the narrative that the country is at war with Islam, something that we tried very hard to counter, because that's right out of the ISIS playbook.
Right.
It shouldn't be our playbook. It's the ISIS playbook.
And yet, President Trump ran against the Obama position on that. He ran on, we have to call it radical Islamist terrorism. It's important to call it that. It's important to pick it out as that. So in a sense, if you consider the election legitimate, he ran on that platform. So, I mean, he's following that through, but it still doesn't mean it has useful effects.
Yeah, just still, at the end of the day, I don't think it has merit. I mean, I get the politics around that, but I think the responsibility of somebody in a position of authority is to really see through what is going to be effective, what's going to work, and understand fundamentally that those labels don't advance our strategy. What advances our strategy is being able to work with Arab countries that are, really on the front lines. And that includes Iraq, taken out of the order, but still, it also includes Yemen and having good relationships with those countries, as well as the rest of the Muslim world. And this undermines that.
Yeah, I want to get back to Yemen in 1 second. I want to ask you one more question about this, and that is, so you were in the administration. The Obama administration received a lot of criticism for, and this is something that Trump played up on the campaign, for understating the threat by not wanting to call it a certain name. President Obama, every time there was a domestic attack, he went out of his way to kind of lower the temperature. Some people said that he lowered it too much, that his temperature was too low, that he didn't send a symbol or a signal that this was something he was taking seriously. President Trump seems to have gone in the other extreme. On the criticism of Obama, I mean, I just want to point out and see what you think. There is a paradox. I agree with you that trying to lower the temperature on the symbols is important, and yet it has domestic democratic effects that are not necessarily helpful to the president. How is a president? This is a hard question, right. But how is a president? I mean, do you think President Obama drew the line where he should have there, and then he just had to absorb the costs of the benefits that he gained from drawing the line where he did?
Fundamentally, I do think he drew the line about right, and I go back, to 2009 when Christmas Day, the attack by Abdulmutallab, and I think that I was working on the Guantanamo review at the time, and we were looking at sending Yemenis back.
Readers understand? Why don't you just give two sentences on what happened that day? It was Detroit, the failed underwear bomber attack. If you could just give two sentences on that, and also. I mean, it had a big impact on the administration.
Yeah, it was really a pivotal moment, I think. And that's I think it helps to answer the question on President Obama's views. We were close to a year into the president's first term in office. He had started that term with this reset, which included closing Guantanamo. And closing Guantanamo meant sending a lot of Yemenis back to Yemen because there were so many. Close to 100, I think, Yemeni detainees. And here on Christmas Day 2009, you have a failed effort to blow up a plane about to land in Detroit by a Yemeni named Abdulmutallab. And there was a watershed moment for President Obama, and others have observed this as well, which really was a wake-up call a bit on sort of first of all, the nature of the enemy and how close we were to a devastating attack in the United States, and also the domestic politics around it, because he was criticized immediately. I think he was in Hawaii at the time, and sort of his reaction didn't seem to meet the needs of the American people at the moment. And I think from that moment on, I think he continually tried to calibrate for himself and the White House and the administration as a whole how to react to these events in a way that both showed that, that did two things simultaneously, showed that he understood the nature of the challenge and that the team around him and the broader intelligence and defense community was prepared to take on the fight, but also that didn't overstate the threat in a way that would sort of feed into a hysteria that's very easy to create and to foster.
And frankly, I don't know whether President Obama drew the line in the right place or not, but I admired what he did simply on this ground, that it's not in his interest. I mean, in a way, it is in his interest. If he's drawing the line in the right place, he's doing the right thing. But the president kind of gains in the short term by the security panic that follows an event like that, and he always tried to keep it under control. It's very hard to know where to draw that line.
It's very hard.
You're balancing two very different things.
I think that's right, but I do think you can see, I do think that even now, And I'm a kind of terrorism person. I mean, I'm not a general foreign policy person. Right. My background in the government in the last few years was working on counterterrorism. But I do, and what I saw in my job was the potential, which I think is not in our national interests, for the counterterrorism effort to swallow up our broader national security foreign policy goals, whether they look at Russia or China or North Korea. And counterterrorism is always that problem that's right in front of your nose, and the politics of it are so visceral that there's a danger that these other longer-term and potentially harder problems and more potentially even existential threats don't get the attention they need.
And that's true not just in the president's rhetoric, but in what's going on inside the government.
I think
that's the worry. So you mentioned Yemen a while ago, and I read in the paper yesterday that we've had nearly as many airstrikes already under the Trump administration this year in Yemen as we had under the Obama administration in 2012, which was the highest year ever in Yemen. So there's clearly been a ramp up of, I think it's drone strikes, but certainly airstrikes. And then there was that raid in Yemen that got so much attention. And so clearly, I think President Trump has decided to dial up that, at least in Yemen, those attacks. And there's discussion, I think, within the Trump administration, or there's been stories that they might be revising and maybe loosening the rules of engagement, or whatever you want to call them, the rules for when and how to target, enemy soldiers. So reflections on that. I mean, is it costs and benefits? How do we think about how to set that dial? And what are the consequences of significantly ramping up? You know, going back to really earlier in the Obama administration, or maybe even greater than that, the use of drones.
So I think I do think this is a challenge that we're facing right now in terms of, or that the government, the administration is facing right now, is how to look at the policies around the use of lethal force outside of hot battlefields, right? So in places like Yemen and Somalia. And as readers of Lawfare know, in December of last year, right as the Obama administration was waning days, they released this policy document that sort of put a framework document that pulled into one place all of the laws and policies that applied to the use of force in these contexts. Very useful, because before that it had been a number of disparate speeches.
Yeah, I actually didn't think that there was anything new in there, but it was hugely useful. There was a little bit of new legal analysis in there telling us which countries and what theories and
right.
the like. But even if it wasn't a lot of new information in the aggregate, bringing it all together made it something really
right.
important.
And I had worked on, during my time in office, had been part of the broader team to consider how to really codify the rules for the use of force and what the standard would be. And really the fundamental point being there was a legal standard under international law and U.S. law, but we were adopting standards that were in excess.
More restrictive.
Right.
So you were constraining yourself in the Obama administration's view beyond what the law required.
Exactly, on policy grounds, and quite explicitly so. So, and I think that, my own experience was that those rules that we put in place, those policy rules were generally effective. In other words, they were operationally effective, and that they didn't really interfere with the goals of our overall CT effort, while at the same time, they reflected the importance of minimizing civilian deaths, which would, in places like Yemen and Somalia, that would have a significantly negative impact on our efforts to work with the local people
and
in those countries.
And presumably with terrorist recruitment as well, I assume.
Yes, and terrorism recruitment, which is constantly focused on this. So limiting civilian deaths, making sure that we have a sufficiently high standard for under what circumstances we would use force, that it wouldn't be simply a lawful military objective as would apply in a hot battlefield like Afghanistan or Iraq or Syria, but rather outside of those areas where it makes sense to me that you would apply a higher standard. Is this person or this group of people, do they really present an imminent threat to the United States? And because one reason to do so is to enshrine a set of rules that we think we can hold out to the rest of the world. Now, you know, people
rest think the world naive. The rest of the world thinks that, we're being pretty aggressive, even with our restraining rules.
That's right. That's right. But sooner or later, these tools are going to be within the capability of other countries to
so we want to draw a line that we can defend.
Yeah.
But defending it on policy grounds does not really, I mean, if we say the legal line is in one place, the policy line is in another, we're basically embracing the broader legal line.
I get it.
I get your point, but how do you, I mean, isn't it, I mean, this is a question. Is it guesswork to some extent knowing where, how much to open the dial up on increasing those attacks as opposed to dialing it down? I mean, you're making a trade-off about the importance of the target and killing or incapacitating certain persons would have an impact on the overall, on the adversary's overall capabilities versus the cost of doing so.
And right.
I take it that's not a science, or is it a science?
No, it's not a science. It's intelligence driven, understanding who the person is and really being demanding about knowing as much as possible about whether or not, first of all, they are a lawful target, certainly, but also are they worthy of targeting in this
way. So one inference we can draw perhaps from the kind of ratcheting up is that they are moving away from the policy restrictions in some sense. They seem to be going closer to the legal line.
So it does appear that if the numbers of strikes are going up in the way that that's being reported, it does seem that.
Okay, let me ask you one last question. This is just so you were in the government for 24 years, which was almost all of your professional life and almost half your life, I think. And now you've been out for how long? A couple of years?
2 years.
2 years. So, and half of that time at least was doing national security work, maybe a little more. So how do you view your work inside the government as a national security lawyer differently, if at all? How do you view government service differently at all? What do you miss the most? I mean, how do you reflect upon it?
I mean, I'm enjoying what I'm doing now. You know, I'm working with a company I helped start in cybersecurity, and it's fun and it's hugely challenging for sure. But I do miss the government. And I think I'm probably, again, like a lot of the folks I worked with in government, this is sort of why I became a lawyer, why I went to law school. And what I always wanted to do was to work in the government on important, hard problems. And I was a bit of a, you know, I was sort of early in my career, mid-career when 9/11 happened. And again, there was a whole cadre of people who would have maybe gone off and done other things, but for 9/11.
Right.
I was a federal prosecutor in D.C. Right. working gang cases.
Right.
And it was sort of the imperative of 9/11 and national security, and that this was the thing to work on that drove me to move into the national security realm. Again, a very common story. You could identify a whole bunch of people just like me. So I actually miss the sense of mission and sense of camaraderie that came with that job and that role. So I, you know, if I get a chance, I'd go back into government as much as I'm enjoying what I'm doing now. But being here at Harvard allows me to hang out with students who are maybe going to do that someday. So that's fun too.
Well, we're very grateful and glad you're here. And thanks so much for this great conversation.
All right, thanks, Jack.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Please spread the word and promote the podcast via your social networks. And thanks for listening.